This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. It's a warm day in 1961, and a gleaming mass of chromium steel has just been unveiled on the NC State campus. The crowd in this black-and-white photograph appears puzzled. Some cross their arms, some cock their heads, all keep their distance. Sculptor Roy Gusso christened his work the Ellipsoid Construction, but NC State students have come to know it simply as the Egg, and it has served as a gathering spot for the College of Design students for decades. Gusso had a hand in creating many other more famous sculptures, including José de Rivera's Infinity, which stands in front of the Smithsonian Institute's American History Museum in Washington, D.C. But the mark he made on NC State as an early member of what was then the School of Design is truly indelible. Roy Gusso died last month at the age of 92. Here to talk about his legacy and that of his contemporaries is Marvin Malachud, who is the dean of the College of Design at NC State University. Marvin, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Roy Gusso was one of many talented artists and designers whom Henry Camp Hefner brought to shape the NC, at that time the School of Design, in the 1950s. Tell me how that school came to be.
Well, Henry Camp Hefner was brought to formulate this new school. It was to be a school of architecture and landscape architecture. And one of the conditions that he put down before coming was that he was to change it to a school of design, which really, I think, in some ways was a tribute to the Bauhaus. He was very much a follower of those precepts and a great admirer of Walter Gropius. In fact, Gropius was an early visitor and I believe, an advisor to our founding dean, which connected us up as the first public school in America to be teaching design by Bauhaus principles.
And what are those principles?
Well, it is a principle that hooks design to industry, to purposefulness, usefulness. It is a tradition of going back to essential concepts, which is what connects into people like Roy Gusso. I think it is a very high energy discovery, the creation of new knowledge kind of environment where even the most basic things were looked at with a new set of eyes. And coming to North Carolina, I think that was the extension in some ways of what was happening at Black Mountain College. And so Henry, when he came, when he was making the deal to come, he was offered the position by the chancellor, but he set down some conditions. And one of the conditions he set down was that he was going to be able to dismiss a full professor who would not be brought into the school. He was going to be able to anybody who wasn't tenured, all those positions would be vacated so that he would have six brand new faculty lines at his discretion, that the person who was serving as the head of architectural engineering would be remaining on the faculty, but he would be given the discretion to hire a new internationally known department head, and that he would be able to raise the salaries of the faculty by 60%.
Wow, so there's going to be some new thinking on this faculty and in this school. How does a guy like Roy Gusso fit into that picture?
Well, Roy was brought in, I believe, because he really believed that that education was about a rebirth, a time to break down preconceived notions. In fact, I'm actually sitting here quoting from something that he said in a taped interview some years ago. He talked about that before you construct anything, you had to destroy something, that instruction with the idea of reconstruction. If you give people the opportunity to discover things for themselves, it becomes meaningful. It is necessary to create that atmosphere, that opportunity. Students should be constantly challenged to question what they've done and not to take anything for granted, not to assume anything. And then he goes on to say experimentation, discovery, and exploitation are the steps of the development of a design concept. Therefore, they should be the steps of the curriculum. And I think that fits so beautifully into what the dean, Dean Camp Hefner, was trying to do. He wanted this common first 2 years on the Bauhaus model. And so he went out and he sought people like Roy. Duncan Stewart was in that model. He went out and found Matthew Novitsky, the designer of Dorton Arena, to be on the faculty. He was finding people who, he wasn't trying to find people of like minds. In fact, he was looking for people who might have their backs to each other walking in different directions with him as the kind of person to bring things together. But he was looking for an energy, and I think it was an energy that really reflected the students who were coming to NC State.
Tell me about that. Let me interrupt you there and forgive me for that. But what was going on at NC State in 1950? Why there? Why would these ideas come to a place like NC State?
Well, I think the people at NC State at the time saw design in a way that was very similar to the way people in Germany saw the Bauhaus. Bauhaus was located ultimately in Dessau because that's where the factories were. Well, NC State as an institution was, with its land-grant traditions, was always interested in manufacturing and agriculture, advancing the society and the culture through the enhancement of its economy. So the School of Design was brought forward because you were going to prepare architects for this new progressive society. You were going to rethink the use of land for growing communities. And ultimately, the first department that Dean Kamp-Hefner wanted to add after architecture and landscape architecture was product design. And that was to help with the textile industry, with the manufacturing industry in North Carolina, furniture industry, for example. So that's what was going on. There was this, I think, energy, this progressive belief that North Carolina was going to have to build its talent base, was going to have to build the people and prepare the people to go forward. And we fit that model. I think it's interesting to note that the original proposers for the new school of what they were calling architecture and landscape architecture were the deans of engineering and agriculture. They were proposing the new school.
If you think about that, engineering, agriculture, textiles, furniture, all very practical, very functional kinds of design we're talking about. When you look at Roy Gusso's work, it was anything but. It was all this gorgeous design, reflective surfaces, impressionistic, but not particularly useful. Where does he fit in?
Well, he fits into the craft. He insisted on the making of things. The precepts of the Bauhaus was that things would have to rise to the level of art by way of becoming skillful and beautifully made, that art wasn't just a free expression of somebody doing things off the cuff. It was a result of a highly disciplined process of acquiring skills and following through from aspirations to results. And so he fits that. And then he also fits in because he was teaching in the first year studios where he demanded that craft. And he demanded excellence, and he demanded an aesthetic sensibility. So the idea is we're sitting in facilities here that were once a factory, but they, in fact, are quite beautiful. There was no disconnect between the beauty of a factory or the beauty of a church or the beauty of a home. Beauty and function came together.
And you knew him a little bit.
I had the opportunity to meet him in his studios when I came as dean. I tried very hard to read everything I could and to meet all of the important people I could. And so we had a program with my development officer to go to New York and meet with alumni. And I asked my development officer if she couldn't please set up an appointment for me to meet Roy Gusso. So I met with him in his studio. And I have to tell you, it was a memorable day. I was there for just a short meeting and ended up spending the day with him.
What was he like?
He felt like I was meeting with a young artist. His mind was alive. I was warned that he loved to drink martinis, and I stopped at two, but he kept going. I was warned that he had a high capacity for that. He was an individual who knew how to really live, and his energy for his work and his work at the time. Some of the maquettes he was showing me were these wonderful combinations of what you'd expect, the polished chrome on one side, but on the other side, a beautifully finished wood. And then incorporating maybe into it a streak of color moving through, almost like an enameled version of color. And it was just, he was continuing to grow. He was continuing to explore. And his passions, his discussions about his arguments with the founding dean, Henry Kamp-Hefner always said that the difference between him and other deans is other deans needed to prove they were smarter than all of their faculty. He wanted to prove that he could hire people smarter than him. Ah. And the result of that was those people smarter than him frequently took pretty tough issue with some of his. And so
what were some of the conflicts that he had?
Well, there were conflicts over curriculum. There were conflicts over freedom to do things in the school. I mean, Henry was an architect, and as an architect myself, there's a certain order that you like to see in your facilities when you walk around. Well, to somebody who's exploring a concept, they might think in the middle of the night that painting a wall a certain color is part of the expression of the moment. Mm-hmm. Well, that didn't sit well with Dean Kamp-Hefner. The freedom to take students out and do a tour of something, or to teach differently, or to be out of the classroom, or to have relationships that maybe weren't so acceptable for the time. All of these things fell out of Henry's understanding of what was acceptable, but But the faculty never backed off of telling him what they thought they needed to
do. However contentious, Roy managed to stay there for about 10 years.
He was there for a little more than 10 years.
Yeah.
And I think he moved on because he could see in his art that he needed to move on. I don't think he left because he was unhappy with anything.
How would you do, you brought a piece here that apparently he did while he was teaching there.
We found a piece in a storeroom. It's not signed, but I've carried it around with me and showed it to some of his students who are now in their 80s, and they all claim that it is it's a Roy Gusso maquette, and it looks very much like some of the pieces that are published, and so I believe that, and it is very much an influence of his time with Moholy-Nagy and Archipenko, I think. It's the point, line, and plane is really apparent in the work.
How would you describe his influence on the school?
I think his influence on the school is continuing through design thinking. I mean, what we like to believe is one of the major strengths of the college is design inquiry, and design thinking is very much a part of that. I teach a course to freshmen. All the freshman students in the College of Design come through my course called Design Thinking. It's two semesters, and it's about essentially what I just was reading about.
Well, thank you very much, Marvin, for being on the program.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I've been talking with Marvin Malika, who is the Dean of the College of Design at NC State University. Just ahead, Piedmont Laureate Scott Hewler on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.